Penguin Random House Audio presents The Loom of Time, Between Empire and Anarchy, From the Mediterranean to China, by Robert D. Kaplan. Read for you by Eric Jason Martin. To Robert L. Friedman. The fact is that we can obtain no more than an impression of a whole from a part, but certainly neither a thorough knowledge nor an accurate understanding. We must conclude, then, that specialized studies or monographs contribute very little to our grasp of the whole and our conviction of its truth. On the contrary, it is only by combining and comparing the various parts of the whole with one another, and noting their resemblances and their differences, that we shall arrive at a comprehensive view, and thus encompass both the practical benefits and the pleasures that the reading of history affords. Polybius, The Rise of the Roman Empire, translation by Ian Scott Kilvert. Rage and frenzy will pull down more in half an hour than prudence, deliberation, and foresight can build up in 100 years. Edmund Burke, Reflections on the Revolution in France, 1790. Prologue. China in the Afterlife of Empire. In the spring of 1994, I first traveled through China's Xinjiang province, a region inhabited by 11 million Turkic Uyghur Muslims who, as I learned from interview after interview, were even then trapped in a grip of surveillance and brutal repression by the Chinese authorities. To the Uyghurs, as well as to geographers and ethnographers, this western outpost of China was historically East Turkestan, the easternmost extension of the deserts and steppe lands of the greater Middle East. China gained control over East Turkestan only in the mid-18th century, even though a Chinese imperial state has existed for 3,500 years. To the Chinese, these Muslims have always represented a dangerous, inchoate force, more numerous and harder to absorb than the Tibetans even. In the town of Kashgar, hard up against China's borders with Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Afghanistan, and Pakistan, 90% of the population of 300,000 in 1994 were Uyghur Turks. Old bicycles, motorized rickshaws, and donkeys laden with produce and firewood crowded the streets. Decaying wooden stalls served up fatty meat and mare's milk. The men wore flat caps and mud-stained sport coats. A greater percentage of women were wearing cloaks and veils than in Iran, from where I had just come. The Uyghur Turks had never been influenced by Byzantium or proximity to the Mediterranean like the Turks of Anatolia, and their unique culture was then in the early process of being ground down by the Beijing communists' relentless threshing machine. Back then, in the mid-1990s, an editor had suggested that my interest in the Uyghurs was testing the limits of obscurantism. It would take a quarter century for the Uyghurs to make it into world news headlines. As I learned during another visit to Xinjiang in 2015, still a few years before the region did in fact make it into world headlines, the intimate chaos of the Sunday livestock market in Kashgar had been moved to a vast rectangular space miles away, where it was no longer integrated into the life of the town. By then, Kashgar had changed beyond recognition into a gridwork of grim apartment blocks, as part of a plan to regiment the daily life of the inhabitants. This cultural sterilization preceded the movement of up to 1 million Uyghurs into penal camps, where they were to be exploited as slave labor. It was the largest incarceration of a religious minority since World War II, according to the Wall Street Journal. The backdrop for this repression was China's $1 trillion Belt and Road Initiative, featuring a postmodern transportation network of highways, railways, and energy pipelines linking China by land and sea with Europe across the greater Middle East. Xinjiang, the homeland of the Uyghur Turks, had become a key nodal point in this 21st century Silk Route, with roads and pipelines going west to Iran and beyond, and south to the Arabian Sea near the Persian Gulf. The Chinese state could not afford to tolerate even the potential for Muslim separatism inside its own borders at this junction where Belt and Road joins Han China with Muslim Central Asia. Indeed, all that stands in the way of defining China's relationship with the Uyghur Turks as outright colonial is Xinjiang's location. Though a frontier province, it still exists within China's legal borders. Yet in a spiritual sense, China's treatment of its Muslim minority, integrated as it is with the perceived requirements of Belt and Road, is the closest one gets to traditional 19th century imperialism in the 21st century. In fact, something worse may have been happening with its forced assimilation and colonial settlement by ethnic Hans. Belt and Road, along with the persecution of the Muslim Uyghurs, is all about the greater Middle East, where China has been equally aggressive at sea and on land. In the spring of 2009, I spent a night in jail in Hambantota, Sri Lanka, after trespassing on a construction site in order to observe hundreds of Chinese workers relocating vast amounts of soil in order to literally move the coast inland. This was part of the process of building a state-of-the-art port for the transshipment of Chinese goods to the Arabian Peninsula and beyond. A year before that, I had obtained a permit to visit the new Chinese-built port of Gwadar, located at a point where the southwestern tip of Pakistan meets Iran and the Gulf of Oman. I had crossed hundreds of miles of the bleak Baluchistan desert in order to see Gwadar's neat and glittering steel angles, spanking new gantry cranes, and other cargo handling equipment. According to the vision of planners in Beijing, oil and gas will be shipped from the Persian Gulf to nearby Gwadar, then be transported overland by pipeline north through Pakistan into Xinjiang province. With China having built a large military base in Djibouti at the mouth of the Red Sea, and contemplating others further north along the Red Sea at Port Sudan, and at Jiwani by the Pakistan-Iran border near Gwadar, it is a great age in history to be a Chinese civil engineer. The Chinese map of the Greater Middle East, which encompasses much more than the Arab world, but includes the vast expanse of the subtropical earth between Europe and China itself, has two critical knots, Pakistan and Iran. The energy corridor from Kashgar in western China south through Pakistan to Gwadar on the Arabian Sea will link the land and maritime silk routes, while the China-Iran Strategic Alliance will make China the leading economic and political partner of a country that, as feared as it has been by almost two generations of Americans on account of terrorism and radical politics, is the geographical organizing principle of both the Middle East and Central Asia. Empire may be dead, because in a globalized world, one culture cannot simply appropriate and subjugate other cultures for its own ends. But the imperial mindset is experiencing a disturbing afterlife, as the example of China in the Greater Middle East demonstrates. Whereas the British East India Company in the early modern era advanced eastward from Europe across the Middle East to China, China is now advancing in the opposite geographical direction westward, though with similar commercial and strategic motives. And as the Americans have tried unsuccessfully to turn away from the greater Middle East, it isn't only the Chinese who have been moving in, seeking energy resources, influence over navigational choke points, and local proxies. The Russians have been militarily involved in Syria and Libya, as are the Turks, even as the Iranians run a network of local armies and militias all the way from Iran westward to the Mediterranean and to the south in Yemen as well. All these countries, it should be said, have long-standing imperial traditions to draw upon and thus feel themselves to be on a mission. For it isn't only the Chinese, but especially the Iranians and Turks, who look proudly on their imperial pasts. Western imperialism may be looked down upon, but not so the record of indigenous empires. The Greater Middle East is the fight zone for these ghost empires, the vast puzzle piece that China needs to command if it can link its budding commercial outposts in Europe with those in East Asia. Here, states are often weak, and in key places...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?